Welcome back, dear audience, to another episode of the Longevity and Lifestyle Podcast.
I'm your host, Claudia von Berzelaga, here to bring you the latest insights and learnings to improve your health, life, and happiness for longer. Thank you so much for being part of this tribe and wanting to be at your best each day. I'd love to keep in touch, so feel free to sign up for my free newsletter by going to LL Insider. My guest today is Dr. Jack Cruz, a neurosurgeon and a health expert who had an awakening in 2007 when he suffered a torn meniscus in his knee at 6'2" and 357 pounds. This led to his further study of physics, light, magnetism, and electricity. He ultimately concluded that modern science lacked a deep understanding of how humans function in relation to the natural world. He became well known for his work on the paleo diet and connection between the brain and gut health. He's also the CEO of the Cruz Longevity Center, where he focuses on helping people avoid common health issues as they age. His first book, EpiPaleo RX, The Prescription for Disease Reversal and Optimal Health, was published in 2013, and he continues to share his insights. With years of experience, he shares insights on biohacking, sleep optimization, and even the impact of electromagnetic fields, EMF, on our health. Dr. Cruz aims to empower individuals to take charge of their health in a more holistic way. Welcome to the Longevity and Lifestyle Podcast, Dr. Cruz. Jack, it's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thanks.
So I'd love if you could share a bit more about your awakening following a torn meniscus in 2007 and how this changed your traditional approach from traditional medicine to looking at how physics, light, and biology are connected.
Well, the way in which the injury happened didn't make any sense from things that I had learned about in residency. And I decided to jump down a rabbit hole. I had a little push. There was an orthopedic surgeon's wife who was there that worked for a biotechnology company in California. Mm-hmm. And she told me, I think I know how this happened. I'd like to send you a book and six papers. And she gave me directions, actually, of I want you to read the book first and then the paper second. And the name of the book was Monk Who Sold His Ferrari. And mm-hmm. then the papers were all about a hormone called leptin. And I mm-hmm. had never learned about leptin because it was discovered after I had finished my training. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of interesting. And I went down the rabbit hole and I realized fairly quickly that she was trying to get me to light Big Pharma up. But instead, I decided to go a different way. My idea was what was present in the book. Was it possible in reality? And I went back to the medical school library in the town that I was practicing in. And magically, I found a pathway that leptin would act with. And that was called the melanocortin pathway. Then I started to read some new papers and found out that leptin linked to this. In fact, the target of leptin was the melanocortin pathway in the brainstem. And one thing led to another. Went and probably read, I'd say this started in 05 and then it went to 07. Then I took my family on a trip to Europe and I was standing at the foot of Michelangelo's statue. Mm-hmm. And that's when the eureka moment came through, where all the things I had read for 18 months actually came together at the foot of the statue. Why? I looked up at David and saw perfection from 500 years ago, and I looked at me and I said, well, I'm not perfect. And as I looked up to look at his behind, a thing of light came down from the cupola, and on the ledge of the cupola, if you've ever been to Florence, mm-hmm. there was actually a bird sitting there. Mm-hmm. And it dawned on me right away, this is the KT event. This is the difference. It's light. Light is the whole deal between leptin and melanin. And then very, very quickly, when I got on the plane the next day to go back home on the Delta flight, I actually started to scribble my quilt document, which is the first document that I ever wrote about this, and started to order things in terms of levees. Why? Because at the time I did my residency in New Orleans, and levees are how we protect the city. And I thought, mm-hmm. well, this would be a good way to order the ideas of how do you protect yourselves with these 30 ideas. Fundamentally, that's where it came down. And the pillars of health are light, water, and magnetism, and you need to optimize all of them. Mm-hmm. And the irony for me was when this whole thing came to fruition, I realized these were the same three things that SETI for NASA looks for extraterrestrial life. Mm-hmm. And they actually have the same mode and mechanism. And the irony is they came to that in a completely different way than I did. But the fact that we both came to the same conclusion, I thought was actually kind of comforting, because they did it through their experimentations in space and space mm-hmm. medicine. And I did it actually from a theoretical standpoint, really from a book and several papers. And then I would say my own N equals one on myself. So then I stood in front of my family very soon after this trip and told them I was going to employ this thing I came up with called the leptin prescription. And my brother-in-law at the time was sitting there, and I told him I'll be wearing your jeans next year. And that was kind of a joke, because he was probably 185 pounds, 200 pounds, and I was 365 pounds at the time. Long story short, in 3 months, I lost 77 pounds. In 1 year, I lost 133.
Wow.
Then, of course, as a scientist, I didn't believe that this actually could fundamentally work. And I did it on my son. Then I did it on my nephew. And I had more success with the younger people than I even did with me. Mm-hmm. And then I decided to make the next step is people that I was seeing in my clinic as a neurosurgeon. I said, look, there may be a chance that I could potentially offset your surgery or potentially make your recovery from the surgery faster. And I told them a little bit about, you know, what I was doing. And of course, a lot of people, you know, they weren't interested. And the ones that were, we did it on, and they actually had spectacular results. So this started creating a buzz in the hospital. And eventually the buzz got so big all over the city that I was asked to do a TED Talk. And the TED Talk was done after me doing this for about 4 years in my town. And several of the doctors that were in my hospital started to send me patients who are not neurosurgical patients. They were people that had diseases that were difficult to treat. Most of them had been to like MD Anderson, the Mayo Clinic, Harvard, Stanford. And the hardest cases that were present in my community, I got a shot on. The people were open-minded, and we had a pretty spectacular result. So one of the gastroenterologists in the hospital told me, he goes, you got to put this stuff out there. He goes, you realize that this is not going to resonate with centralized medicine and peer review, because they're going to try to rip this apart. He goes, you're going to have to come up with a different plan. Prior to that, because like I said, this began for me in 2005. We're now at about 2010, 2011. Early on in the journey, when I realized that the physics of organisms was the key to understanding circadian biology, I went and visited a person who became my mentor. I mean, this is a person that I didn't physically meet, only through his books. And that was Robert O. Becker. And he was at the end of his life. And I sat down with him, and he told me what he faced with the industrial military complex. And when you find a fabulous idea, you think as a scientist or a doctor that people are going to meet, you know, this progress with open arms. And that's actually not the truth. Why? Because the industrial military complex, and it turns out Big Pharma, who are partners in most things, and when you filter them down, they come through pretty much money and control. He just told me the way in which you do this, you need to be careful. So with that idea in mind, I began to do something that I don't think anybody else prior to me in medicine really did, where you try to educate, you know, a swath of people on what really matters and then subtract out the superfluous. Because it turns out most of the things in centralized medicine, most of the things in longevity, they are superfluous. And the thing is, in order to get people to that level, you actually have to teach them what really matters, and then you have to teach them consistency and how to do it over and over and over. And the nice thing is with my work, the consistency part is not difficult. It doesn't cost a lot of money. Everything that I teach people is kind of free. With the exception is you may have to change the way in which you live your life, the way in which you do your job, the way in which you're a mother, a father, you know, a caretaker, or even a surgeon. Like one of the big changes for me was we used to start our cases 6:30 in the morning. That changed. I didn't start any of my cases till 8:30 after that. Why? Because sunrise is a non-negotiable situation for me. And that's kind of how the process started.
It's beautiful, and especially how amazing to have a eureka moment in front of something so perfect like Michelangelo's David. So I've had the pleasure of also witnessing it as well, and for taking action. So really, thank you for your work in that space. Where would you say for people trying to understand, because as you said yourself, it is a industrial complex, if you will, of traditional medicine, and many people are understanding only one way of thinking. How do you explain to people who might be new to your methods and way of thinking?
Well, it's actually easier now. It's actually much easier now to have this discussion with people than it was, I'd say 10 years ago, 15 years ago, or 20 years ago, because of what everybody just went through with COVID. Here's the perfect example. The perfect example is the government narrative was that we should stay out of the sun, social distance, and do all these things. And we saw what an epic fail that was. And then they put the whipped cream and cherry on top of the sundae and said, look, the jab is the best way to go. And it turns out if you took the jab, boy, do you have a huge problem to deal with, you know, now that the aftermarket data has come out. So actually, I think my message has gotten much, much easier for people, because what you have to realize is that you've been preconditioned, but not only by the system, by your parents, by schooling, everything about centralized medicine is about precognition, meaning that you have been preconditioned to accept, you know, what they tell you, and they're the experts, and you'll do it. For example, when you go to see a doctor, no matter where you are in the world, whether it's Europe or the United States, you know, if you don't get a prescription for it, you feel like, well, this was a waste of time. And that idea comes from the preconditioning you got. And when you begin to realize that the person who really preconditions everything in medicine, who gave doctors that idea, who doctors gave the patient the idea, that was Big Pharma. And that started at the turn of the 18th and 20th century. That started with the robber barons in the United States, who basically had one of their oil trusts broken up. And then from the breakup started the idea of Big Pharma, which started in New Jersey. And they started to use industrial chemicals to place in pharmaceuticals. And at the same time, how did they get physicians at that time who were much more interested in electricity at the time than now? Because electricity is a big part of light, water, and magnetism. They actually came up with a guy named Flexner to come up with a report. And in the report says, this is how we're going to fix schools. And what the idea of the Rockefeller Foundation at that time is, if we can change the curriculum, we can change the culture of medicine away from vitalism and then towards reductionism. And that's exactly how it happened. The problem is most people today, you know, you're 130 years, 120 years away from that. You don't realize how all this went on. And there was a lot of politics around that. You had to know what else was going on. The Federal Reserve was beginning in the United States. There was a huge problem with the royal family in Britain. All these things played a role in terms of how it happened. Basically, slowly over a period of time, the paradigm for about 30 years was changed from 1911 to 1930s and 40s. World War II starts to break out. We have war. And then what is the single key moment that solidified that the Rockefellers would win? It was actually Alexander Fleming discovering penicillin. And when penicillin comes out, it's truly a miracle drug. It does things that no other drug's ever done. And what does that do? Kind of pushes everybody to the belief that there's a drug for every ill. And that was reinforced post-war America, post-war Europe. It was reinforced everywhere in the world. So there's other things that happen at that time. In the 50s, we get the idea that UV light's bad. Why? Because of a paper about retrolentinal hyperplasia in children, because when they were born with, kernicterus or jaundice, they used to put babies in UV light. So that's where the babies all got better from the jaundice. But the interesting thing is they noticed that they started to have problems with their eyes. And that's actually where the first idea that UV light in the sun was somehow toxic. Again, nobody looked at the embryology of the eye, why this was a problem, or the fact that UV light from the sun never comes packaged by itself. It has six other colors with it. Mm-hmm. And then they changed from UV light and started to use blue light. And if you go back and look at pretty much any epidemiologic problem, most of the big diseases in the world start from 1893 when Tesla, Westinghouse, give us the power grid in the world. And we start plugging things into it, specifically light. And those lights are not similar to what the sun is. Mm-hmm. That's how the story starts. And the doctors who were marginalized by the Flexner Report are basically thrown out of their academic positions. They're removed from medical schools. And you can see there's a whole culture change that goes on for about 50 years, which brings us to right around the late 1930s, 1940s, same time when Alexander Fleming does what he does. Another chap who you may have heard of, named Albert St. Georgi, wins a Nobel Prize partially for the Krebs cycle and partially for vitamin C. The irony was he was right about vitamin C, but he was wrong about the TCA cycle, but it didn't matter. He was a brilliant guy and he was a physician. He happened to give a speech in 1941 where Robert O. Becker, the orthopedic surgeon that I told you about in the beginning of this podcast, was there, and he made this comment in there. He said, if you look at proteins, and remember, this is a pre-DNA time. DNA is not discovered till 53. He makes a comment to the medical students that are there that proteins look like they have an electronic structure. They almost look like semiconductors. Now realize, at this time, quantum mechanics is in it. It's still not even known as the way everything operates. It starts in about 1890 to 1905 until Einstein comes in with Planck and all them. It's still being developed. In fact, quantum electrodynamics and quantum chromodynamics doesn't get its Nobel Prize until the 1960s. That's with Feynman and Schwinger. So we are right in the middle of this. And this doctor who wins a Nobel Prize for vitamin C said, I think we're filled with a bunch of semiconductors because of the atomic structure of proteins. So Becker hears this, and literally in 25 years, he definitively proves that Albert St. Georgi's hunch was correct. Now, the crazy part of this, from those 25 years, what happens in the United States? We move away from an industrial revolution and we enter the information age. The information age where it's based on semiconduction, but semiconduction of silicon, not carbon. And this is where you have technology companies begin to explode. The Manhattan Project is the single thing that drove most of the big tech innovation. Most people don't know this. I know Europeans don't know American history well, but Americans don't even know it well. Why? Because as I told you before, the industrial military complex has tried to hide a lot of this from Americans, so they don't understand how these things link. Mm-hmm. So back in 1942, when FDR, this happened in 39, Albert Einstein writes a letter to FDR that he thinks the Nazis are going to create an atomic bomb, and he knows a lot of the players that are involved. The number one guy that's running the nuclear program in Germany is Werner Heisenberg, who came up with the uncertainty principle. And this letter really alarms FDR. FDR then puts people together. At that time, there was only one intelligence agency in the United States. That was the FBI, that was formed in 1908. Ironically, because of some of the malarkey that went on with the royal family, JP Morgan, and in finances. So the guy that's leading that charge is a guy named J. Edgar Hoover, you may have heard of. And there's another guy named Wild Bill Donovan and one of his proteges named Kennan. From 1939 to 1942, the FBI and this OSS, which is the precursor for the CIA, these guys are fighting about intelligence, about what's really going on in Germany. A civil engineer who went to West Point, who is really good. He knows a lot about science, a lot about engineering, and a lot about the military. So he has a very unique viewpoint. He's very different than the generals that are that you've heard of in World War II for the Americans, like Eisenhower, MacArthur, and Patton. His name is Leslie Groves. He gets tapped by FDR to run the Manhattan Project because he has an ability to do all these things. He has a skill set that's appropriate for, you know, a huge industrial project. The first thing that Leslie Groves does, ironically, given what we've already said in the podcast, he goes and meets with Henry Ford and Rockefeller. And why does he do that? He knows that both of these men are in big industrial applications, and he wants to know about their process, about how you built cars and how you retooled from Standard Oil to create Big Pharma. So he gets a variety of different ideas from them. But the number one idea that he gets is that he's told by both men, and neither men knew what each other had told Groves, that the most important thing is that you need to silo people in what they're good at doing. And then you need to stay proximal to that so that you can link them all together. It's good for productivity and also limits the effect of sabotage. And of course, Groves, realizing that he's creating the biggest industrial project up to humanity at this time, this occurs. So one of the guys that's in FDR's cabinet, who becomes much famous later on in U.S. history, is named Alan Dulles. In fact, if you ever flown to Washington, D.C., Dulles Airport is named.
Dulles Airport, yeah.
Dulles is in charge of an operation that Wild Bill Donovan and Kennan come up with. It's called Operation Paperclip. Operation Paperclip goes to Europe and poaches all the best scientists that are Jewish because the Nazis are coming to get them. And believe it or not, that's how we get almost all of the people that work on the bomb. I didn't say all, but 80%. And we get some kind of wild cards in there. In fact, one of the people that we get, a lot of people doesn't know, is Wernher von Braun, who actually brings all the rocket technology from the Nazis to the United States. And that's actually the birth of NASA. So I always tell people, before you think Hitler's completely bad, realize that he gave us some pretty big ideas in the United States, but we stole them. And FDR basically put all these scientists together with Groves. Groves makes the bomb, and he does it from 1942 to 1945. What happens at the end of the war is not very well known in America, and it's certainly not well known in Europe. You guys were much more interested in the Marshall Plan and how we rebuilt Europe. But two seminal events happen that Groves is involved with. The first one, you know about these meetings that we have, Churchill, Stalin, and FDR. Well, the second one is with Truman. The first one is at Yalta, and this is where FDR basically tells Stalin, for you defeating the Nazis in Germany, we will rebuild Russia. You gave 28 million people, and we're going to do this for you. That kind of infuriated General Groves. And Churchill wasn't very happy either, because you know Churchill's history. He didn't really like communists. But he also had dictates from the king at the time, which is King George. I believe King George V. And George wanted to make sure that they kept the power over the seas to reach the colonies. Churchill didn't have much to say at Yalta, but he was very concerned, and so was Groves. Groves then comes up with a plan to get a better vice presidential candidate than FDR had. Why? Because at the time, FDR's got polio. He's in his third term. We have a DNC conference coming up in Chicago in 44. And he hand selects Harry Truman to replace Henry Wallace, who was a 3-term vice president. Why does he do that? Grove's idea immediately is after the war. He wants to set up an industrial military complex that's within the United States military. His idea is to morph the office of OSS with Bill Donovan and Kennan into the Central Intelligence Agency. Okay, that's where the idea is born. But it's born in all the things that happened in the Manhattan Project and in 1944. Most people know their history of the war. The bombs are dropped in the summer of 45, but I told you, we started in December of 44. FDR dies, and General Groves' hunch is correct. In April, Truman comes in. At the DNC, he gets Jimmy Burns, who's a politician in the United States, to replace Harry Truman, I should say Henry Wallace with Harry Truman. And the reason they do that is they want to create a Manchurian candidate that will do what they want to do, specifically set up the industrial military complex. Now, remember, all the leaders of industry in the United States, the guys that I'm telling you, Rockefeller, Ford, bankers, everybody is behind Groves' plan. They think this is a good idea. Why? Because they see how successful they are in building the bomb very quickly. The bomb at this time isn't even tested. It's tested. The final test is at Trinity in the desert in July of 1945. Mm-hmm. But when everybody from industry and everybody in the military sees it, they're stunned. They are truly stunned because nobody believed that they actually could do it that fast. Mm-hmm. And everybody in history is told about Harry Truman's thing on his desk that says the buck stops here. Do you know who put that on his desk?
No, who?
General Groves. And General Groves is the one that decided to drop the bomb. And this is what creates the big rift. The reason why the industrial military complex is no longer inside the government. It actually is forced outside. Why? The generals that were in Europe at the time, Eisenhower, Patton, MacArthur, they are absolutely furious what's going on back home. They feel like General Groves is a guy that is a babysitter of all these scientists. They have no earthly idea kind of what Groves is doing, but they look at it as their soldiers. They're taking care of people dying on the front. And Groves is getting all this applaud from back home, and they don't think he really did too much. So it turns out it's Eisenhower that eventually speeds this whole process up because he basically convinces Truman that Groves needs to go. And Groves has no place in the military in a post-war world. Now, just think about this. This is a guy that creates the atomic age, and you have people in the military trying to force him out. So it's a power struggle. Mm-hmm. So who wins? It turns out Eisenhower does win. But on the way out the door, General Groves, in the National Security Act, it's an executive order in the United States. Literally, it's a paragraph that's this big. He turns the office of the OSS into the CIA. And that's how it begins. Then it gets crazier. Groves leaves the military. He goes in private life. And Eisenhower this whole time thinks he wins. If any of you don't know American history, who's the president after Truman? It's Eisenhower for 8 years throughout the whole 50s. So Eisenhower thinks he's won. And what Groves does on the outside of the government, he has liaisons between all the people in the CIA. Then he gets two companies. One is called Remington Rand, who is the number one producer of guns for the U.S. military during World War II. Then he merges with another company called Burroughs, which is a simple machine company that makes, you know, calculators, sewing machines, things like that. Nobody can figure out what he's doing. Remember what General Groves does. He's a corps of engineers, mm-hmm. engineer general. He basically takes these two companies and creates the first computer company in the United States. It's mm-hmm. called Sperry. And what does Sperry do? General Groves realizes from 1947 to when Eisenhower comes in that there's not going to be a lot of kinetic wars left. This is going to be wars about information. And mm-hmm. how did he come to this realization? Believe it or not, some of the people that he put in place in the CIA, like Wild Bill Donovan and Kennan, had an opportunity when Alan Turing was still alive to go visit MI6 mm-hmm. and when they were working on the Enigma code. Mm-hmm. the royal family never let, and Churchill never let, the Americans see what they were really doing. But it was very clear to the American military that information technology and cryptography was a really big deal. Okay. Mm-hmm. And this is something America did not have at all at the time. So Groves gets this idea, creates this outside the government. Okay. And what happens next? The 1950s in the United States was probably the golden age under Eisenhower. That's when everything was spectacular. But the industrial military complex grows from a small little seed and becomes a monster. At the end of Eisenhower's reign, this is now 1960, General Groves has military contractors everywhere. This is where Halliburton, this is where the oil people are involved. This is where all big tech, the seeds of big tech in the United States are built outside the military with links to the CIA and FBI. Mm-hmm. And shockingly, Eisenhower realizes in his last year that he has been played big time by General Groves. General Groves leaves what he built in 1961. But on the way out the door, Eisenhower gives this famous speech called his farewell speech. And in that speech, he makes the comment to the American public that you need to be very careful with the industrial military complex. And how crazy is this story when you realize that in 1958, everything that General Groves built on the outside, Eisenhower says, I got to have this on the inside. And what does he do? That's where DARPA is created. And DARPA is created at the end of Eisenhower's reign. And many of the pieces that General Groves built is actually then reabsorbed. Like the organizational structure is then reabsorbed back into the government. And again, you'll see there's 120 silos in DARPA. And believe it or not, DARPA didn't start out with the D in front of it. It was ARPA first. Mm-hmm. And for those of you who are following this story, you may remember the first big thing that General Groves and the industrial military complex build is ARPANET, which is the forerunner of the internet. This is where it starts.
This episode is brought to you by Apollo Neuro. Since I began wearing my Apollo in November, I've hardly taken it off. Literally, I'm obsessed. Apollo's wearable technology uses soothing vibrations to naturally regulate your body's stress responses and improve sleep quality, crucial for long-term health and longevity. You can wear the device on your wrist, ankle, or clip to your chest, and the paired app has different vibration settings for waking you up in the morning with more energy, to focus time, calm, and helping you wind down in the evening. It also has an innovative stay asleep feature, which turns on if you begin stirring during the night, allowing you to sleep soundly throughout the night. Users report up to 19% more deep sleep, a 40% reduction in stress, and an 11% improvement in heart rate variability. Apollo tailors also for women, helping to manage stress associated with hormonal fluctuations. So if you're looking for a way to enhance your well-being and support lifelong health, you'll love Apollo. It's not just a wearable, it's a lifestyle enhancer. Check out Apollo Neuro today and save an automatic 15% off an Apollo wearable by visiting apolloneuro.com/Claudia. That's apolloneuro.com/Claudia, C-L-A-U-D-I-A, or use code Claudia at checkout. This episode is brought to you by Sunlight and Saunas. As part of living your longest, healthiest life, discover the power of Sunlight and infrared saunas, where heat and light combine to support nearly every system in your body. Infrared sauna therapy is a natural whole body longevity hack that eases the effects of aging with every use. Enjoy improved cardiovascular health, better sleep, reduced inflammation, and a stronger immune system, all from the comfort of your home. For 25 years, Sunlighten has led the way in light science. Their patented heaters deliver the best infrared quality on the market. The M-Pulse Smart Sauna stands out with its advanced technology and customizable settings, offering the most effective infrared experience available. Ready to transform your wellness journey? Visit sunlighten.com and mention code Claudia, C-L-A-U-D-I-A, when you fill out the Get Pricing form to save up to $600. That's sunlighten.com and mention code Claudia on the Get Pricing form to save up to $600.
And what it was is designed to link academics all over the world. Remember the story I told you about Operation Paperclip? Yeah. Now you're seeing the digital format of this story. The digital format of Operation Paperclip is General Groves is getting all the scientists everywhere in the world to communicate. That idea was born in the Manhattan Project. Now it's been modernized. In other words, it's evolved. Mm-hmm. So that's how it comes to power. And at the end of 1960, all the people that were germane in forming it, specifically the productionists, the industrialists like Ford, the Rockefellers, they sit at a position that's right next to the industrial military complex. And for you to understand why this complex has a huge play in centralized medicine, in healthcare and longevity, this power seat that they built basically becomes the strongest part of the US military. And it actually begins to make most of the big decisions that occur down the road. And one of the things that happens through the 60s and into the 70s and 80s in the United States is they get the idea that the government needs to control healthcare. And this is where you get HMOs. This is where you get DRGs, you get ICD-9 codes. What is the design for this? Is to subtract time from doctors so that they can focus on algorithms. What also is going on in DARPA at this time, they are creating algorithms that they eventually in 1994, 95 give to Sergey Brin and Larry Page. Mm-hmm. And remember I told you, everything is preconditioned.
Yeah. But
the problem is if you don't understand the history, you don't understand how the system is built, you don't understand where the preconditioning comes from. Mm-hmm. And this preconditioning really started actually in World War I with the family fight, which was the royal family that mm-hmm. went to the world stage. And it turns out the royal family lost more at that time than anybody else, even though we're on the winning side. And then what happens? The United States cedes control and then basically installs terms that almost guarantee a second world war with the Treaty of Versailles. And when you begin to understand how this whole thing unfolds, you begin to realize the same problems that you see in COVID are tied to the construction of this system. We've kept scientists siloed. We mm-hmm. make sure that nobody talks to each other. We make sure
and medicine.
Right, everywhere. Mm-hmm. And when doctors are going through, they're taught enough, but they don't question the system. Mm-hmm. And what is evidence-based systems now in centralized medicine? It's all algorithmic medicine, meaning it's recipes. So when you come in to the ED and you have supraventricular tachycardia, we have something called the BLS or ACLS algorithm that all doctors are supposed to go through. And it's reiterated through your training. No doctor thinks anymore. They just look at an algorithm. Mm-hmm. You're treated the same way in surgery. You're treating the same way with hypothyroidism. It's everywhere in the system. In other words, this idea of using algorithms is actually like a software program. And when you begin to understand that this happened from the merger of Burroughs and Remington Rand and Spurry comes up, what does Spurry eventually become? It actually becomes Unisys. Unisys is one of the biggest industrial military contractors you can imagine. That happens in 1986. What does Unisys physically do? They work with Harvard University and Stanford University to come up with ICD-9 and DRG codes. And these things are the pillar of what has ruined American medicine. But it's ruined American medicine, but it's good for the industrial military complex because remember what General Groves' goal was? Total control and domination of the system. Because remember, he's a process engineer, and he mm-hmm. fundamentally had the belief that you have to get rid of this individuality in people so that you can get a common task done.
Standardize it, basically, to get the data to train the algorithms.
And that's yeah. what centralization mm-hmm. is all about. Well, mm-hmm. when you come back to the story that we started the podcast with Jack at the foot of Michelangelo's statue, nature, which uses light, water, and magnetism, is completely decentralized. In other words, there's no single controller. Nothing is siloed in nature. There's a light and a dark cycle. There's melanin and water. There's so many coupled cycles, it's not even funny. And they all have to work in unison in order for us to become who we're going to become. What really happened at the foot of that statue is because I happen to know the history of centralization in industrial America and information technology America. You now are seeing evolution 3.0, where you're going from the industrial revolution to artificial intelligence. And I can tell you, artificial intelligence is absolutely the single worst thing that could happen to humanity. Why? Because anything where it's used to centralize the process further, meaning your sovereignty for choosing, your sovereignty for freedom and liberty gets subtracted out. Why? Because there's a controller that controls the whole process. And the saddest part of this is that the population of the world needs to realize that artificial intelligence, when you actually sit down with these people, I guess the number one place it's being used in medicine right now is in longevity. So it's a really bad idea, and they're trying to put it everywhere. You need to realize that artificial intelligence has no target at all. If you sit down and ask, in decentralized medicine, what's the target? That one's simple. It's our children. Our children are aliens. They're an alien between mom and dad. They have pieces and parts for each one. They're not the same as each one. They're different. And they actually operate on the same software program, light, water, and magnetism, that everybody else operates on. And when you begin to see that, and then you see from 1960s to now, doesn't matter what country you're in, people are doing much, much worse. Why? Because many of the things that have come out of DARPA and the industrial military complex is actually really not good for health. Why? Because they destroy the key tenets, which is light, water, and magnetism. Like the number one for your audience who's probably not realizing, the screen technology that we all use. Screen technology creates blue light. Blue light destroys the signaling, the optical signaling in the leptin melanocortin pathway. But what else does it do? It dehydrates your mitochondria. So when you begin to realize that you don't create as much water as you get older, and this can happen now when you're 20, 30 years old, you begin to understand why kids are getting sick. You know, as teenagers, this is why suicide levels are up. It's also why kids are getting, you know, neurodegeneration at ages that you can't fathom. But you haven't put two and two together. And I try to explain to people the simple ideas, because explaining the physics to them kind of makes their head explode. But I tell people, think about a baby that comes out of its mother's vagina. It's a ball of fat. It's a nervous system that's not fully developed. But the child is 80% water. Then correlate that with your grandmother or grandfather. They're 80 years old, 90 years old. They're only 50 to 55% water. All of a sudden, you start to go, so aging and longevity has to have something big to do with water. And the other thing you'll find out is when you go down this path long enough, you'll find out that the older you get, the harder it is to make vitamin D. So what does that tell you? It tells you as you age, you need more sun, not less. That's exactly the opposite of what you're told in centralized medicine. And when you start stringing these things together, you start going, you know, we're not told any of this in centralized paradigms and frameworks. In fact, almost everything you're told in centralized medicine, everything you're told in longevity is exactly the opposite of what decentralized medicine tells you. And the only way that you can understand my paradigm is to take a walk through history to understand how the paradigm was changed, you know, through the industrial military complex, through the corporations in America, through the executive and legislative branches. Because guess what? Everything America did in post-war America was then globalized everywhere in the world. Everybody has this belief that America is somehow better and smarter than everybody because we won two world wars and we bailed most of your asses out, you know, in those wars. I think the one country that would argue with that pretty loudly is Russia, and I think they're right about that. Turns out Russia has done more work on decentralized medicine than the United States has done in the last 100 years. And how did I learn a lot of this when I went through this epiphany in 2005 to 2007, I spent almost $100,000 translating Russian articles on biophysics into English, because at that time there was no books on quantum biology. Now, people listening to this podcast, you won't have to spend that kind of money. But in the beginning, I had to do that. And that's where I found out that all living cells make extreme low frequency UV light through something called biophotons. And when I started to see all these little pieces, and these were not opinions, these were not conspiracy theories, then I started to think about some of the big ideas. I said, why is it that America has Google, Intel, and Microsoft, and all these cell carriers, but Russia doesn't have any of it? And Russia has had all the information like we have. And remember, Russia built the bomb right after we built our bomb. It turns out Russia had the same information later than General Groves did, but they went a different path with it. And that's the reason why to this very day, their non-native EMF regulations are radically different than those in the United States. And for those of you who think Russia's a really bad player, when Stalin was still alive, he sent some of his scientists to Los Alamos in the Sandia nuclear labs to tell them that there was huge problems in biology if you use non-native EMF to build out tech weapons. It turns out all General Groves' friends in the military complex convinced Eisenhower at that time that this was, you know, propaganda of the KGB. And it turned out that was the wrong decision. Why? Because the generals in the United States that were linked, this is a pre-DARPA world, they were still PTSD from World War II. They thought, you know, Russia wasn't our friend. Who was the number one person that drove that ideology? Is actually General Groves. Why? Because the second meeting that I told you about, I glanced over it. After FDR dies, we have a meeting at Potsdam. Potsdam now is between Truman, Churchill, and Stalin. You know what General Groves told Truman at that meeting? Everything that FDR promised Russia, tell him, kiss our ass. It's going to be the reverse. You are now going to be our enemy in post-World War II. And that's actually how the Cold War started. It began at Potsdam.
Wow.
And this explains, you know, why Russian science is very different than where we are. But you know where we are right now in the world. Don't you find it a little bit amazing that the one place Russia and the United States get along really well is in space? Didn't you see that we just brought an American astronaut home on the Soyuz rocket? So remember what I told you. Light, water, and magnetism is big in space medicine. And it turns out this is where our two governments actually seem to work well together, because each government has a big time respect for the science that underpins life and biology. The problem is it's not allowed to be brought to the American public as it is in Russia, because it would, how shall you say, unravel many of the things that underpin DARPA, which is the industrial military complex and big tech. If people really knew how dangerous big tech was with chronic abuse, you'd find out that all the things Bobby Kennedy and Nicole Shanahan are talking about in the United States, the chronic disease epidemics, were actually brought to the world because of what General Groves started in 1942.
Fascinating to hear the history. Thank you so much for sharing that. I hadn't heard that part of it. I'm familiar with what Bobby Kennedy's talking about, and Casey and Callie Means, who I know as well. And I think there is momentum in Washington to shed light on what is really going on. And hopefully there will be a paradigm shift again by raising awareness. But I'd love to tap into practicalities and advice and tips as well, right? So around the light, the water, the magnetism. Could you break down each of those? And what are some practical modalities that you recommend, from light exposure and you know, you're sitting outside in a beautiful location in El Salvador, but for people maybe that live in cities, etc., what are things that are non-negotiable that you would recommend everyone do? Obviously, avoiding blue lights. Yeah.
The number one Pareto principle, 80% of your health and longevity is going to be tied to seeing the sunrise every day. of your life from this day forward. That is non-negotiable. So I don't care where you are. I don't care if it's raining. I don't care if it's cloudy. Mm-hmm. You get out and you look to the east. So what do I tell people? I tell mm-hmm. people to make like the Sphinx. Why? The ancient people knew about this. At the 28th mm-hmm. latitude, the Sphinx faces the sun. All four extremities are grounded to the earth. You mm-hmm. should do exactly the same thing. The problem is, if you live in a city, you can't really ground to the earth really well because they put power lines below the ground. So you're going to have to find a place, probably using a body voltage meter, to make sure that you're able to ground below. And the effect of grounding, again, is, believe it or not, a quantum mechanical story. We're the only primates on the planet that have eccrine sweat glands on our hands and our feet. That's designed to make a connection with the tectonic plates to get free electrons in there. If you know anything about what I told you earlier about Albert St. George, Becker, and the leptin-melanocortin pathway, it's a semiconductive program that needs electrons to operate. So anytime mm-hmm. you can get free electrons, you get them. Most people mm-hmm. know that electrons come from food. When foods are broken down, they're broken down to protons and electrons. That's really what food is. Food is an electromagnetic barcode of where you live on the planet. So for example, I'm assuming you live in Europe, high latitude, coconuts and pineapples don't grow there. So you have no business of going to the grocery store and eating them, even though everybody like Cali means and Cassie means tells you they're healthy. They're wrong. They're dead wrong. Mm-hmm. Okay. It has to be what photosynthesis provides for you at that latitude. Mm-hmm. So that makes diet really, really easy. All you need to do is go talk to a farm and say, what grows at my latitude? That's much easier to do, believe it or not, in Europe than it is in the United States. Why? Because in the 1960s, the industrial military complex centralized farming. Europe is now ongoing with that right now, which is why you have the farmers throwing, you know, manure at the politicians in every major capital, you know, in Europe for about the last 2 years. Why? Because they've ceded control to the World Economic Forum to try to do the same thing that they already did in the States there to get control of the food. And then I guess the last part I've already answered with water. Most people don't realize that your mitochondria reverse the photosynthetic process that's present in plants. So most people in third grade learn that plants work by taking CO2, water, and sunshine and turning into sugars. Your mitochondria reverse that process. So what does that mean? They take sugars, proteins, and fats and create water. And it turns out the water that you create isn't like the water in your tap. And what's the major difference? The major difference is an atomic mass of hydrogen. Hydrogen comes in three formats on Earth. Comes in light form is called protium. The second form, which has an extra neutron, is called deuterium. And the third form is a radioactive form, tritium. Tritium plays no role in biology at all, but it turns out deuterium and protium play a huge role. And it turns out mitochondria are racist. They don't like any deuterium. In fact, the ATPase, you can't put a deuterium through it. And that's by design. And you have to learn about how this works. It turns out the hydrology cycle on Earth makes total sense when you understand this deuterium protium story. So for example, people in Europe, you have a much better water hydrology cycle. Why? Because it turns out the higher you get to the poles, water is deuterium depleted. The water at the equator has a lot more deuterium in it. And that mm-hmm. has huge implications for us. Why is it like that? It turns out deuterium depleted water works better with light. It's not encumbered by atomic mass. This goes back to the funny little guy from Bern in Switzerland named Einstein, where E equals mc squared actually elucidates why this is true. Mass is a big problem. Well, deuterium has double the atomic mass of light hydrogen. So it turns out for longevity, you need to learn about all those steps in biochemistry. Like I always tell people, have you ever wondered about all those steps in biochemistry and why it happens? It's very simple. It's to make sure that at the end, light hydrogen is in the water that the mitochondria makes and that deuterium is kept in the blood. Mm-hmm. And there's a biophysical reason for that as well. And when you begin to understand water from that modus operandi, you begin to say, okay, this makes some sense. And then the last part that we really didn't talk that much about, which is, I think, the mysterious part of the three-legged stool, magnetism, Most people know that magnetism is a force. Light, the force carrier of the electromagnetic force is the photon. You know that photons have an electric field and a magnetic field. They're at 90 degrees to each other. But magnetism in biology is very different. It uses magnetic chemicals to control timing in cells. So for example, every single free radical that you've ever heard about in the longevity space, it's not what they tell you. In fact, free radicals are one of the single most important things because they are the things that determine how tissues make decisions between the TCA cycle, the PPP, glycolysis or gluconeogenesis, and where those free radicals act tells you. Now, how can I explain to you simply that free radicals are magnetic chemicals? Very simple. Every free radical has an unpaired electron. Unpaired electrons, when you put them in an EPR machine, which measures their magnetic moment, voila, you see it. So there's not one out there that isn't. And it turns out when you go through what I went through in 2005 to 2007, you look at all the key chemicals in the body, you'll find out something very interesting. The body tends to use atoms that are paramagnetic. What does that mean? It means they're drawn to a magnetic field. So again, you're beginning to see another side of centralized medicine that you never got told in medical school, certainly not as a patient. And it turns out, what's the most interesting paramagnetic atom on the periodic table? It's one that all of you are familiar with. It's called oxygen. Oxygen is drawn to anything that creates a magnetic field. So when you look at the fifth cytochrome, which is called the ATPase, you'll notice that it has a current that comes in through electrons stolen from foods. It's called the electron train transport. Then it's got this FO head that spins. This goes back to the English people listening to this. Well, like this, this is Michael Faraday's idea about induction of current. It creates a magnetic field. So now fast forward to the 1980s, 90s. We now have machines called MEG machines where we, as neurosurgeons, which is what I do, I can measure the magnetic field over your brain and heart. It actually tells me how good your mitochondria are. Tells us how impressive oxygen delivery will be to different areas. It'll give us clues about what's happening with the decisions in unpaired electron moieties like nitric oxide, hydrogen peroxide, the hydroxyl free radical, superoxide, all these things. And you begin to put all this together and you begin to realize that magnetism controls timing and timing controls how energy flows in a system. All these ideas are based on the physics that started with Helmholtz, Planck, Einstein, went through Ilya Pirogine, Fritz Popp. Like I just gave you big time scientists all the way through the 20th century and probably ends in Richard Feynman because his science defines all this stuff. Now, none of you listening to this have to believe that Uncle Jack is telling you the truth. Why? Because the essence of nature in the 20th century was worked out by all of these scientists. And every time we've checked quantum mechanics, guess what we found out? Millions of times. It doesn't lie. It's like a zero knowledge proof of biology. But guess what? That's not what the industrial military complex wants you to know. So this is the reason why the practicality is going to be different for people that live at the equator and then people live at the high latitude. So to fully answer your question, because I am going to cut to the chase, my people come from the 59th latitude, okay? That's up where Edinburgh is in Ireland. Yet I live at the 13th latitude. Why? Because of something I told you earlier. Longevity is determined by how much sunlight you get because sunlight creates how much water a mitochondria makes. So as Jack has gotten in his 60s, what has he done? He's moved from 59th latitude all the way to the 13th as he's gotten older. And I just laid out to you why. Now, if you're like you or your audience and you decide I'm going to stay at high latitude, how do we do it? I did a podcast with a young boy, 23 years old, named Owen Sheesby. He's from Edinburgh. I would tell you, go listen to that podcast because I tell you how to live a high latitude life well and improve your longevity. Is it possible? I would tell you, up until my belief, the 1970s, it was possible and easy to do. Mm-hmm. Now it's become very difficult because we've now invited technology into our lives, and that has reduced the margin of safety of high latitude living. The best example of good high latitude living with longevity is found in the people of Iceland, and you'll be shocked to know why. Everybody knows this, that's a 63rd. But why do they have good longevity? They live on a volcano, and a volcano delivers huge magnetic flux through the ground. And guess what used to happen in Norway and Sweden and, you know, Scotland and the UK? That hotspot has moved east. Iceland is right where it is. So they get the benefit that used to be present in Scandinavia and the UK. So what are the remnants of those ideas that are left in the cultures of the people from Scandinavia and the UK? The embrace of sauna through geothermal heating. And the other part is cold thermogenesis. Why? Just think about what happens in Russia, what happens in Finland and Scandinavia. People there will embrace the cold. It turns out the cold actually changes your mitochondrial DNA to make more light endogenously inside you. And you create more of those biophotons that Fritz Popp talks about. So what does that do? It turns on the key gene in humans called POMC, stands for pro-opioid melanocortin. Oh, see how that ties to the leptin melanocortin pathway? And it turns out that you create light inside of you that mimics what you're missing from the sun when you live above the 50th latitude. So you can do that. But what destroys that? When you open a computer screen that's blue lit, when you put Apple's things in your ears, you know, when you're constantly on your cell phone, you know, 18 hours a day. No, those things then don't work. And then you get subject to the sausage grinder that is the people that run longevity, and they convince you to take all these supplements and do all this nonsense that is completely superfluous. Then eventually, when you lose enough money and you get sick, you come and listen to a podcast that I've done, and I tell you why you've been lied to.
So we know the sauna, we know the cold plunge, we know avoiding blue lights as well. What do you think of the EMF mitigation devices and balancing with like a PEMF mat? It's obviously not ideal to actually be in nature. But
blue light is the number one EMF. People forget that if when you learn physics, and this is something that's not well known, both in centralized medicine and longevity space, is there's only one way to mitigate non-native EMF. That means everything outside the visible spectrum and the Schumann resonance. It's called the inverse square law. That means you have to be far away from it, okay? Now, that's a real problem in continental Europe. It's a real problem in the United States. So the United States is a little bit different than Europe. We have population centers and cities. So what the goal is, since you know that each human now uses between 12 and 15 devices each, your goal should be to live in places where it's rural, where there's not a lot of cell phone towers. In fact, I'm one of the few people that tell you that a 5G tower is not going to hurt you when you don't have a lot of people around it. Why? Because if you understand the inverse square law, the more people that use the tower, the more it emits. That means the more you're getting irradiated. But if you only have 10,000 people in your town versus, say, Mexico City, which has 15, 16 million people, you can see it doesn't take a rocket science to figure out why Mexico City is not as good as maybe your farm at the 52nd latitude. Because it turns out that the effect of non-native EMF in a huge city at a better latitude offsets, you know, the what you think is the detriment. And this is the thing that really screws people up when they think about this. And that's why I tell people, I still believe you can do well at high latitudes if you understand how to hack EMF. PMF mats, all that stuff, that is all bullshit, okay? Subtract it all out. You can use them. I don't have a problem with that. But the more times you use their solutions, generally you create problems. Why? Because I'll give you the example of the mats themselves. With the industrial military complex in the United States and in Europe, specifically the guys that work for Ericsson, we've gone from 0G to 5G. What's happened in 0G to 5G? We've manufactured the wavefronts that we're using to communicate so that it can do some good things for the cell communication tower. Turns out it's really bad for us. Why? Because it simulates jump conduction. So if you have an insulator or conductor anywhere around you, that wireless technology can jump onto that conductor and deliver it right to you. So when you begin to understand Becker's work and you understand that it's actually about a DC electric current and how light flows in your system, can you understand how stray voltages and stray signals get in there? It's almost like how I like to describe it to people. When you understand what Albert St. George and Becker really said, that we are a bag of semiconductors that are hydrated. Mm-hmm. And if you know anything, like the minimum about semiconductors, when they're made, they have to be done in a plant that's extremely clean. Why?
Yeah.
Because semiconductors lose their efficiency if there's any dopants or pollution in them. And mm-hmm. it turns out that's true in our semiconductors. Like our bone semiconductors between collagen and apatite, we use two copper atoms to do that. Those two copper atoms pop off like they did in 1971 with the Russian scientist. Becker's the one that figured out why they died up in space. It's because those copper ions popped off because there was no protection from the magnetosphere up there. No one's actually asked the question you just asked me. Could the same thing be happening on the surface of the planet now that we've gone from 0G to 5G? Guess what the answer is?
Yes.
That's exactly what's happening. And what happens is the real problem with supplements, the real problem with vaccines, the real problem with medications that we take is we are adding pollutants into a clean room of semiconductors. And that changes the signaling of the light that your mitochondria make. That changes mm-hmm. everything about you. You begin mm-hmm. to realize why Jack says the exact opposite of what everybody else says in the longevity space. Because it turns out they don't know the science as well as they should. Because what are we doing? We're using things that make us sick. General Groves in the industrial military complex and DARPA have sent all over the world. Now, it has some good connotations. It's allowing me and you to talk, you know, over the computer. But I want you to know that you have to go on a tech diet. That's the real big issue. And
detox,
the more things that you try to use to mitigate technology, you're actually creating a bigger problem. So if you mm-hmm. think those phone cases work, they don't. Okay? They don't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Nothing really helps except one thing, the inverse square law. So how do I describe the inverse square law to people who don't get it? Would you let your child stick their head in a microwave and then hit the popcorn button? Because that's effectively what you do when you give it an iPad. Yeah. In fact, can I tell you the person that invented the iPad knows this? And can I prove it definitively? Oh, yeah. Steve Jobs. Read his biography. What'd he mm-hmm. say? He said the iPad 2, they put a device in it so that when the device touches the child's skin, it turns off the Wi-Fi signals. And you want to know the crazy part of the story? Crazy part of the story, Apple never told anybody it was in there. Why? Because if Apple would have told you that they had this in there, you would have asked the next question that General Groves didn't want you ever to know about. Is this harmful for me? And guess what? That's the reason why General Groves and his buddy canceled Robert O. Becker. That's the reason Uncle Jack went to go visit Robert O. Becker. Because guess what? After that 18 months spent really parsing out all his work and figuring it out, I realized I can't go through the same process that Robert O. Becker went through. Now, I'm at the end of my career, officially kind of retired, but a lot of people want to hire me now. But I will tell you that I never had a lawsuit against me, never had any problems with my license anywhere. So did I successfully navigate the situation once I actually found the truth? The answer is yes. So what am I doing now? Now I'm the biggest agent provocateur you're ever going to find. So what did I do? I brought all this information to a little country named El Salvador and sat down with their president and told them all the things that I'm telling you in this podcast. And what did he ask me to do? I wrote a constitutional amendment for medical freedom for the president here a year ago. And guess who he shared it with? Bobby Kennedy, Nicole mm-hmm. Shanahan. So if you want to know where MAHA started, it started a long time ago because mm-hmm. of the meetings that I had with Bobby and Nicole. And now that information has been handed to Donald Trump. And you know that Nicole and Bobby are now part of the transition team. So remember what General Groves really did. He sent all this like MS-13 all over the world. to harm people. Now I'm reversing the process. I'm giving the answers to the people who actually will be on the transition team to try to take the monster apart.
So it's going back to nature, essentially, right? So spending time in nature, away from artificial light.
Stop for a minute. Let's talk about that. How much does that cost? Tell me how much does that cost?
It's free.
All right.
I mean, you have to live, but it's free.
Right. You just have to retool how you live, right? You have to do things a little bit differently. You have to tell the dermatologist, how can I believe you anymore when you, Bill Gates, and the ophthalmologist are trying to block us from UV light? But yet, here's a tweet from Dr. Cruz that shows every living thing emits low-frequency UV light. So explain this to me. They can't.
They don't know.
Dumbfounded.
They don't know. Yeah, they don't know.
So guess what? You need to realize that the biggest gateway to modern chronic diseases is listening to Bill Gates, the dermatologist, or the ophthalmologist. You want longevity? Do exactly the opposite of what they tell you to do. That is the practical advice after the sunrise. Okay? The next thing is, go drink deuterium-depleted water. Next thing is, try to live close to where volcanoes are, because that'll help you. If you're really sick, the best place to be is inside a crater that has a lake. Now, there's not a lot of those in Europe, but you do know there is some volcanism in Europe. It's sitting in the Mediterranean. So even though the southern Med is 33 latitude, guess what? There's places there that are good. Here's the big problem with the Mediterranean. They put all military and Navy radar on all the great islands there. So like Sardinia, Cyprus, you know, most of the coast of Greece and Italy, it's mixed. It's a mixed bag. So that's the reason why everybody who's European goes to the south of the Med, and they're like, it must just be that I'm on vacation. I feel better. No, it's light water magnetism is way better there than it is in Northern Europe. Now, are there exceptions? Why do the Alps work? Because the higher you go up on the mountain, the more UV light you get, even though you're high latitude. Most people don't know that. But the problem is Switzerland is unapproachable for most Europeans because it's even more expensive than New York City, Los Angeles, or Chicago. You have to be uber wealthy. And then you'll find out that's the reason why all the people that go to Davos live in Switzerland, and why they're telling you that you should reduce your carbon use while they fly their planes all over the world. You need to begin to realize that those people in Davos are tightly aligned with General Groves, DARPA, and the industrial military complex. They're the same guys tied to that guy, Gates. I remember what I told you. Gates, dermatologist, and ophthalmologist. Well, they all have in common. They want to block the sun. Why? Because it's good for profits.
Yeah. This has been such a pleasure, Jack. Thank you so much for sharing your extensive knowledge and for the history lesson as well that really went deep. I really appreciate that because you're the first guest who's dug there. And I think that there is such a beautiful opportunity for people, for things that don't cost that much, to get back to nature, to be aware of the dangers. I think many of my audience are very familiar with the dangers of blue light and mitigating it, etc. But definitely takeaways of rising with the sun, regulating the circadian rhythms too. So I really, really appreciate you coming on and sharing that. Do you have any parting messages or thoughts or recommendations for my audience before we close today, Jack?
Yeah, optimal health isn't a mystery. It's a choice. Mm-hmm. And all you have to do is choose to optimize light water magnetism. If you do that and you subtract out the superfluous from the centralized experts, you can do well. And you can do well just about anywhere. You just have to be wiser than everyone else. And I'll end with this one to blow Darwin and Richard Dawkins up. And most of the longevity guys, optimal health or survival of the fittest is no longer about totally being fit. It's survival of the wisest in a planet whose surface has been electrified. So be wiser about how you use the power grid and the things that plug into it. And you too can win and do very well in the face of the establishment.
Beautiful. Jack, thank you so much for taking the time to come on today. It's been such a pleasure to have you on.